Here now to talk to us about the politics of the debt downgrade is NPR's Cokie Roberts with us most Monday. Good morning, Cokie.
Hi, Renee.
The Obama White House was very unhappy and very open about its unhappiness with this decision. It tried to forestall it, but S&P went forward anyway. What now for the Obama administration?
Well, first, the Secretary of the Treasury, Tim Geithner, has announced that he will stay through the election. He was eager to get back to his family in New York, so he now has to stick around. But look, there are lots of reasons for them to be angry. There was a $2 trillion math error in the original S&P report, and when they recognized it, they basically changed their rationale from an economic one to a political one. That is that the debt deal is not good enough, and they don't believe the American political system can fix the debt. There were lots of particulars in it to make each party unhappy. And yesterday we heard members of each party highlight the part that worked for them. So the Republicans focused on the fact that the S&P report said there was not likely to be enough entitlement reform. And the Democrats focused on the fact that the report said they didn't believe that the Bush tax cuts would be allowed to die. And S&P thought that that would be a good thing to let them expire. But what's got both parties really kind of irritated is that S&P did make a political judgment rather than a straight economic one. And they don't like the idea that apparently these credit raters are deciding the French political system is more likely to work than the U.S. one.
Well, what about that? I mean, even S&P said, yes, it was really a lot about the politics of this country. I mean, how does that fit?
Well, they had a conference call on Saturday, and I called in on it, and they made no bones about it, that they were making a political judgment. They're essentially saying they don't believe that the Congressional Super Committee, still to be named, will do the job on the debt that it's assigned to do. And after listening to the partisan responses yesterday, there is reason to agree with S&P on that. And then overnight, Renee, we had news that former Oregon Senator Mark Hatfield had died and reminded us of how few lawmakers like him are around now who could do a deal like that. But having said that, there's still a lot of upset here that S&P is engaging in what amounts to political punditry and can affect the U.S. economy with its punditry. And there's not a huge sense that they're calling it straight, some sense that they're making political judgments for political reasons.
Well, if in fact it's a bit of that or much of that, if there's a partisan political agenda, is it that S&P execs are doing this to harm President Obama?
You're not hearing that. I mean, some Democrats say that because they see conspiracies behind every bush. But it's much more that people saying that this is S&P payback for being called over the coals by the administration for their role in the economic crisis. You just heard Chris Arnold referring to that. The truth is it was a congressional coal raking as well. The Senate Permanent Committee on Investigations, in a totally bipartisan report on the economic crisis earlier this year, repeatedly blamed S&P and the other ratings agencies for being, quote, the single biggest triggers to the economic meltdown. And by the way, Renee, the recommendation of the committee, the government shouldn't pay attention to these ratings agencies.
Well, though intended or not, what political effect do you think this downgrade will have on the president?
Oh, I think it could be very devastating for him. Time magazine has George Washington with a black eye. The Republican presidential candidates get to say this is the first time in U.S. history that this has happened. It's happened under this president. Unless he has a magic wand to turn the economy around, President Obama is in for a tough slug over the next year.
Thanks much. That's NPR's Cokie Roberts. Let's stay now with the economic fallout from the downgrade of the U.S. credit rating, as well as troubled economies in Europe. That's caused markets in Asia to plunge today. NPR's Anthony Kuhn joins us from Jakarta, Indonesia, to talk about all of this. And Anthony, how bad is the carnage on those Asian markets?
Well, stock markets in the region are down between about 2 to 5%, which means billions of value were wiped off them. That's on top of last week, which saw the biggest rout in Asian stocks since 2008. Hardest hit were the companies that export goods to the U.S., such as Sony and Toyota, and the banks in the region that loan to them. At the same time, the currencies of China and Japan jumped in relation to the dollar, which, of course, is just what those exporters don't want to see because it makes their goods more expensive.
Right. China and Japan are big exporters, especially to the U.S., and are the top two holders of U.S. Treasury bonds. So the U.S. downgrade has amplified calls by economists for China and Japan to, for one thing, stop stockpiling huge amounts of dollars. Can you explain to us what that all means in today's context?
Yes, well, a number of economists in the region have been saying for years to their governments, stop intervening in markets to keep the currencies low and exports cheap. Let the markets decide the exchange rates. Let the yen and the yuan, which are Japan's and China's currencies, respectively, appreciate. Now, why they're saying that is when we're in a debt crisis like this, the debtors have to find some way to pay off the creditors, right? So there are different ways of doing this. If you default and restructure your debt, that's one way, which is painful, or you can print money and inflate your way out of that. But another thing you can do is you can adjust the exchange rates, and what that would do would be to increase the creditor country's buying power. Japanese and Chinese consumers would have more money in their pockets. They could import more goods. It would make up for sluggish wage growth. It would lower inflation. So among methods, it's seen as something that's got to be done.
Well, are the governments of those countries responding to these calls for reform?
Well, basically, it's a very tough call for them. Either way, they're going to lose money. They have to look at which is going to cost them more, hanging on to dollars, which lose value, or losing export revenues when their currency appreciates. But I think what the economists are saying is one way or another, the dollar is going to go down and the Asian currencies are going to go up. So they have to just go with this momentum and let the markets take their course.
NPR's Anthony Kuhn speaking to us from Jakarta. Thanks very much.
Thank you, Renee.
It's been just over a year since a copper mine collapsed in Chile, trapping 33 men underground and alive. The world watched as they managed to survive half a mile below the surface for 69 days. And then, after a dramatic rescue, they ascended as celebrities. One of the journalists who reported on the scene was Jonathan Franklin. He's had close access to the miners since their escape, and we reached him in Santiago. What made you want to follow the lives of these men after they escaped the mine?
Well, I've been a journalist long enough to know that fame is very fleeting. And you could kind of see this setup where these working class heroes were dumped into the media treadmill. These guys had no idea how to work with the media with this dose of fame. And it's also a bit of a schizophrenic existence. You know, one day they're in a 5-star hotel in Tel Aviv, and then right after that they fly home to Chile where maybe they don't even have running water.
Well, how many of them ended up trying to go back to their old lives, just be miners again?
Two of them have gone back to working in the mines, and the rest of them are looking for work. Some of them have vegetable stands. Some of them are truck drivers. One is even a boxing promoter. Psychologically, a lot of them would say, I'm going back to mining. I'm a tough guy. I'm a miner. But I remember one of them explaining that he lasted 2 minutes, and he was so scared that he got dizzy, and he ran out of the mine. Another man, when he started looking at the mouth of the mine, he started crying. And I said to him, but Victor, you're out. You survived. And he said, yeah, but my happiness is still inside there.
I wonder about post-traumatic stress. Did any of them suffer from what could be diagnosed as post-traumatic stress after this experience?
When I spoke to the doctors and the health officials, they said that 32 of the 33 were diagnosed with post-traumatic stress. Some of them had nightmares. Some of them had trouble relating to their children. Others were fighting with their wives. One man was building a big wall around his house. Literally, I mean, he was building like a 4-meter-high wall all around his house. When I speak to these men, they talk about going to the psychiatrist, taking lots and lots of pills. But you get the sense when you talk to them that there's been no collective or group effort to solve these traumas.
So 32 of the 33 were diagnosed with post-traumatic stress. What about the one?
The only one who wasn't was the preacher. He really was able to avoid a lot of the psychological problems. His unbending faith and his leadership role really allowed him to have done very well. He really seems to have skirted a lot of the problems that torment his fellow miners.
It's troubling to hear this because these miners were such an inspiration to people at the time, because they worked together under pressure, because they organized a little society for a while. And it is sad to hear that there's an aftermath to that. There's still a price for them to pay.
Yeah, I believe that they had this really incredible ability to create a unified community underground. But what they've told me is what really messed up their life was television. They sent a television down there and a projector. And from the moment they turned on the TV, they started to have all sorts of discipline problems. And they started getting fights over what they were going to watch. Some people stopped doing the chores and just watching TV all day. And a lot of that group feeling fell apart. By the end, they were even sending back the food saying, you know, the desserts aren't warm enough. Or they would send back their iPods saying that they didn't like the music selection. So there's this real dichotomy between the union they had when they were completely cut off from the world and they had their own society, and this bickering and conflicts that began once the television and other so-called conveniences were put down to them.
I wonder if that change is going to be reflected in the movie that's going to be made of them now that they've just recently sold the movie rights.
It's hard to know about the movie. We've heard lots of rumors and there's been all sorts of speculation, but I think that this is finally the real deal. In this case, they've been very unified and the 33 men have agreed to share all revenue from the movie. They have a great Hollywood producer, a big team behind them. So I think that they finally will get their movie off the ground, and that should be a huge psychological boost as well as some cash. I think that the men need to feel loved again. They feel abandoned at this point.
Journalist Jonathan Franklin wrote a book called 33 Men about the Chilean miners who were rescued a year ago. Thanks very much.
Thank you.
Here's something else that might seem impossible with young children, getting them to eat something like broccoli. I did see a kid eating broccoli over the weekend. It just wasn't my kid. New research finds that you should start trying this early, very early. Gretchen Kuda-Crohan has this report.
It might surprise you to learn that the amniotic fluid that cushions a fetus in the womb is not just bland, tasteless stuff. It turns out it's flavored by the foods and beverages a pregnant woman has eaten in the last few hours. Julie Minella studies taste in infants at the Monell Chemical Senses Center in Philadelphia. Minella says garlic, vanilla, mint, even a glass of wine or smoking a cigarette produces pronounced flavor changes in a woman's amniotic fluid or breast milk in as little as half an hour. To test this, she gave women garlic capsules or sugar pills before taking a routine sample of their amniotic fluid, and then asked a panel of people to smell the samples.
And it was easy. They could pick out the samples easily that came from the women who ate garlic.
But here's the really interesting part. Vanilla says that not only is the amniotic fluid in breast milk in humans flavored by food, but memories of these flavors are formed even before birth that could result in preferences for these foods or odors for a lifetime. Vanilla says this had already been observed in rabbits, so she decided to test it in humans with carrots. Women were divided into three groups and asked to drink carrot juice every day during their pregnancy, or during breastfeeding, or to avoid carrots completely. Then, when the infants began to eat solid food, researchers fed the babies cereal made with either water or carrot juice and videotaped their responses.
And just like the European rabbit, the babies who had experienced carrot and amniotic fluid or mother's milk ate more of the carrot-flavored cereal, and when we analyzed the videotapes, they made less negative faces while they were eating it.
This makes a lot of evolutionary sense, explains Minella. Since mothers tend to feed their children what they themselves eat, it's nature's way of introducing them to the foods and flavors that they're likely to encounter in their family and in their culture as they grow.
It's providing so much information to that baby about who they are as a family and what are the foods that their family enjoys and appreciates.
That very idea got Maddie Lau thinking. How is it that kids in other cultures eat foods that are spicy, bitter, or have pungent flavors? She's Chinese American and recalls growing up eating foods most American kids she knows would never touch.
I always wondered, like, how is it that I grew up, you know, as a Chinese American, being able to eat bitter vegetables like kale or mustard greens and things like ginger?
At the time of this interview, Lau is 8 months pregnant and consciously trying to eat the flavors she loves from her native Chinese cuisine in the hopes that when her baby is older, it will share her love of flavorful food.
I think there's just lots of different kinds of flavors that don't show up in places like McDonald's or Applebee's. And so I was really concerned that my child, you know, enjoy food as much as everybody else in my family did.
University of Florida taste researcher Linda Bartoshuk is familiar with Julia Minella's work on infants. She agrees that very early exposures to flavors, both before and after birth, make it more likely that children will accept a wide variety of flavors later. Bartoshuk also thinks that when early exposures are reinforced, they might have implications beyond taste preferences, even promoting good eating.
To what extent could we make a baby eat a healthier diet by giving them exposure to all the right flavors? Broccoli, carrots, lima beans, etc. Could we do that or not? My guess is we could.
Julie Minella acknowledges that early exposure is not a guarantee of anything. Many toddlers will still make a sour face when given broccoli, no matter how much a woman eats while pregnant. And it's entirely possible they'll never like it. But she says parents should keep exposing young children to these flavors. Her research shows it takes about 8 tries before little children begin to like a new food. For NPR News, I'm Gretchen Kuda-Crowen in Cleveland.
And we're also happy to announce that Maddie Lau has given birth to a baby girl named Josie.
I'm Allison Keyes, and this is Tell Me More from NPR News. Michelle Martin is away. Coming up, we'll talk about the perks the millennial generation wants on the job and how employers are working to meet them halfway. But first, you've been telling your friends not to post those silly photos of themselves clutching brimming beer mugs or worse, posting angry or threatening status updates. Now that may be coming back to haunt them, thanks to the Social Intelligence Corporation. The company searches everything you've done publicly online for the past 7 years and reports back to prospective employers. But will the increasingly blurred lines between our social and work lives end up costing you a job? To talk about the rising use of social media background checks, we invited Max Drucker, CEO and co-founder of Social Intelligence Corporation, and John Verdi, the Senior Counsel for the Electronic Privacy Information Center. Welcome to you both, gentlemen.
Great to be here.
So, Max, let me start with you. If you've got the skills, you're qualified for the job, you're not doing anything illegal, why does it matter what you're doing on Facebook or Twitter or whatever?
Well, Social Intelligence Corp only looks for employer predefined criteria. And that criteria is racist remarks, potentially violent behavior, illegal activities such as drug use, and sexually explicit material. We do not look or report on anything else, so that job applicant really is able to have a robust and strong online presence without fearing being discriminated against based on some post of them drinking beer, or even worse, something that such as them being a single mom and that coming back to haunt them because an employer made a hiring decision illegally based on that information.
So what kind of activities do you look at and where do you look for them?
We look both on the major social networks, but we also look broader to the message boards, to comments on news articles, to the photo and video sharing sites. And we are looking for very specific things. We are looking for people that make blatantly racist statements. We are looking for people that are flagrantly displaying a weapon, an assault rifle, pointing it at the camera.
Wait, let me ask you a question, though. I mean, because assault rifles are legal in some places, so why is that a problem?
Well, the employer has the right, and the employer chooses what we are to look for. And if an employer is not concerned about that, we don't identify it. To answer the question about why this may be relevant, that's up to the employer. But an argument they may make is, well, this isn't illegal, and this is their right to do. They may not feel that a person is representing them the way that company would want them to represent themselves publicly.
John, let me bring you into the conversation, because the idea of poring over someone's internet footprint can be alarming to some privacy advocates. But if it's stuff that you have publicly put out there yourself, why is it a privacy issue?
Well, I think it is alarming. I think the reality is that these sorts of social media background checks are here to stay, regardless of whether it's social intelligence, whether it's employers doing this work themselves, or whether it's another service. So the reason why one might be concerned about this sort of social background check is that many social profiles on Facebook, Google+, Twitter are necessarily incomplete. Individuals use their privacy settings to reveal some information to the public and to not reveal other information to the public.
Right.
To take your example of an individual with an assault rifle, if you were to take a photograph of an individual with an assault rifle and you take that photograph out of context and you put it in a background check report, what you don't learn is that that individual was recently discharged from the Marine Corps, that that photograph was taken while they were stationed overseas in Iraq. And the employer has no way to know that, nor does social intelligence have any way to know that, unless the individual has revealed other information about themselves beyond the photograph on a social networking site. So context is important.
If you're just joining us, this is Tell Me More from NPR News. I'm speaking with John Verde, Senior Counsel for the Electronic Privacy Information Center. I'm also joined by Max Drucker, CEO and co-founder of Social Intelligence Corporation. Let me ask you both a question. Just a couple of years back, anything that you did outside of the workplace pretty much wasn't your boss's business, right? But if you go to pulling people's comments on news stories and checking into whether somebody tried to buy a car or something on Craigslist, that might strike some as a pretty extreme intrusion into your personal life. I mean, it's kind of, as one commentator I saw suggested, like having your boss send someone to the bar you're at, listen to your conversation, and then come back and tell your boss what you said. I mean, John, isn't that kind of like being on the clock 24/7, everything you do and say?
Well, yeah, the legal considerations aside, there's a real human question to ask here. And the question that we need to ask is, do we want to put vastly more information about employees' and job applicants' private lives in front of their employers or prospective employers? And do we want that information to have any kind of relevancy guarantees concerning their employment status, concerning their job description? That's a question that we as a society need to ask ourselves. How much privacy are we willing to give up and put in the hands of our employers who, let's be honest, control our paycheck?
Max, explain why it's okay for a boss to have that level of control over what the employee is doing.
Employers are in a really tough spot in the age of social media. If they're one of the 80% of employers that are doing the internet screen themselves, they are exposing themselves to all kinds of things that aren't legally allowable or frankly not relevant, and thus are violating that job applicant's privacy. But on the other hand, they have an obligation to protect their existing employees against major risks, which really fall into the same categories as why they do the traditional screens, such as criminal and drug. The way we solve this problem is by only identifying predefined criteria and ignore everything else.
Let me ask you, Max, does your company do ongoing monitoring of people or just the one-time background check?
We do ongoing monitoring, but purely to the specifications of enforcing a company's social media policy.
So how is that not basically having somebody standing over said person's shoulder every time they're at the computer?
Well, most corporations or many corporations monitor activity on their internet use and on their computers. But a company has the right to have a social media policy, and that's part of their employee handbook.
John, what kind of different privacy concerns does ongoing monitoring offer, if any?
One of the major risks is that companies' social media policies are often illegally overbroad. There was one example recently in the state of Connecticut where an ambulance worker took to the social media site to complain about her boss, who she believed was endangering workplace safety with some of the decisions that he was making on the job. Now, that sort of speech is actually protected under the National Labor Relations Act. Employees are entitled to talk about workplace safety concerns without penalty and without reprisal. However, she was fired from her job, and the National Labor Relations Board had to intervene. All of those actions by the company were consistent with its social media policy. And that company's social media policy was no employee may post anything on social media about the company.
Let me ask a final question to you both. First, John, if you've got stuff out there that you shouldn't have out there, do you just take it down or do you try and find a way to explain that when you go into the job interview in the first place and try and avoid this? And Max, I want you to answer it after John does.
Well, I think everybody has the right to pull down information that they previously have shared on social media sites. And if someone is going into a job search, I think that they would be wise to do a self-assessment on their social media profile. As to explaining it, I think context is critical, and the real question is whether or not individuals are going to be given a meaningful opportunity to provide that context within the job search.
Max, same question to you. And again, you're going back into 7 years of data, so explain how much saving here people have an opportunity to do.
Well, we can use anything that goes back 7 years, but everything we're still looking at is publicly available. It's what's out there right now. And yes, I totally agree with John. You should do some sort of self-assessment. But I'm also a major advocate that a person can have a very strong online profile and a positive one. And social intelligence also identifies very specific positive criteria for those reports and redacts anything, again, that's not legally allowable.
All right. I've got to leave it there, gentlemen. Max Drucker is co-founder and CEO of Social Intelligence Corporation. He joined us from Santa Barbara, California. John Verdi is senior counsel of the Electronic Privacy Information Center. He joined us from our Washington, D.C. studios. Thank you, gentlemen, both for a spirited conversation.
Great.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Here in the United States, the National Football League has had its own trouble to contend with lately after a lockout with the Players Union over a new collective bargaining agreement. Fans were hoping to see some action on the field this past weekend at the Hall of Fame game.
That's the traditional first preseason NFL game. It's played in Canton, Ohio. The same weekend athletes and coaches are inducted into the Pro Football Hall of Fame. This year's game between the St. Louis Cardinals and the Chicago Bears was scheduled for yesterday.
But today's last word in business must be ticket refund, because the NFL canceled the Hall of Fame game. Team owners and players did reach an agreement, of course, just not in time to get this game going. Around 14,000 tickets had already been sold, and the NFL says it is providing a full refund. The Hall of Fame weekend is important for the Ohio town, Canton, and in a statement, the NFL said, obviously, the loss of this year's game will have a significant adverse economic impact locally. But not every weekend event was canceled. We can tell you that. This year's induction ceremony went on as planned on Saturday. The regular NFL season begins in a month. That's the business news on Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Steve Inskeep.
And I'm Renee Montagne.